Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported by the Great American Whiskey Fair, brought to you by Bourbon Columbia. Now in its fifth year in Columbia, South Carolina, the fair, with more than 500 whiskeys available for tasting, is one of the largest celebrations of American whiskey in the Southeast, and tickets are already on sale for this year's event on September 28th. This year, the event is promising to be even bigger, with a new exhibit space for whiskeys from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and Japan. And there will be a barbecue feast by Bourbon and Loco Barbecue all day to keep bellies full. For more information and to purchase tickets before they're gone, visit experiencewhiskey.com. I still write extensively, and thus, I still receive a lot of food news, usually in the form of emails from PR reps. I can read beyond the hype, but when hotshot New York City chef Michael Toscano decided to come to Charleston, South Carolina, my town, to open a restaurant in one of my former favorite downtown watering holes, well, the buzz machine seemed to hit a new level. I had the reaction that I have a lot to incessant chatter before a restaurant opens, which is usually turning away with a wait-and-see approach. Give us a minute. Let's see that new single drop before the musician accepts the Grammy, right? But Michael, who has worked for Thomas Keller and helmed kitchens for Mario Batali and been one of Bon App's best new restaurants with Perla and a Zagat 30 Under 30 and a James Beard Rising Star Chef nominee. Whew. Behind all of that, Michael is not the hype. He's a man who is obsessed with cooking. It took me a while, but I started spending more and more time in his restaurant, La Farfalle, and then we started spending a little time chatting and sipping Amaro at the beautiful bar there as the night breeze blew in through open doors and the sound of traffic gave way to the sound of cicadas in the trees. I'm happy he and Caitlin decided to live here and raise their family. And I am happy that he sprinkles mustard seed and dehydrated cantaloupe on prosciutto di Parma. So as we all spend the last of summer this weekend, I invite you to sit with us and then get ready for fall with a discussion of pasta that will have you craving it. Welcome to the Southern Fork, Michael.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I am so happy to have this time to chat with you, but it's not 11 o'clock at night, and we aren't sharing obscure or new Amaros that you've brought into your bar, so I'm not sure how this is going to work out.
I should have brought one.
It's okay. Amaro is more for after dark, I feel like, although
I wouldn't have turned it down. You can always make it Amaro
time. That's right. You can always make it Amaro time. So Michael and I have spent some time over the spring really chatting and tasting Amaros and having some fun. So I thought it would be a good time to have him on the podcast before the fall gets crazy and everybody starts thinking about pasta again. That's right. So you just celebrated your year anniversary.
I did.
Right?
It was awesome.
What does that mean to you?
I mean, it was huge. Coming down to Charleston, I knew would be a challenge, and a challenge we were ready to accept. And it definitely was one. It was definitely a huge learning experience. but nothing we were surprised by. So we were ready for it. We were ready to adapt. We knew we weren't moving to a small New York. We knew where we were coming. And we embraced it, and we thought it was a successful year. And, you know, the amount that the restaurant has grown over this past year is tremendous, tremendous. So we're super happy with where it ended and where we're going into the next year. It's pretty exciting for us.
And you spend a lot of time in the kitchen, even though you're kind of fancy as a chef. You spend time in the kitchen, and you're in there working on the dishes and really like expoing the line a lot of the time. So how has Charleston changed you as a cook? How has that informed your cooking?
The huge difference of cooking in New York versus Charleston, you really have the opportunity to know where your food's coming from. Mm-hmm. Not that you don't in New York, but it's such a personal thing here in Charleston. And I embrace it. I love it. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that you know your farmers, you know exactly where it's coming from. They come in to eat. You know their families, you know all about everybody. And that's that personal touch that I just love about Charleston. And it's been amazing getting to use those ingredients that are coming right out of the water. These gorgeous pigs that we're getting that are being butchered the day before we get them. And it's really exciting to be in this small town, much smaller area where we're using new ingredients for me. And I'm getting to incorporate that into Italian cuisine, the repertoire that I've been used to cooking. Mm-hmm. So it's been a fun, kind of enlightening way of cooking for me that is not a different style, but it's a different focus on how I'm creating dishes and kind of a different way of putting
them
together.
So you're starting at a different point.
That's right.
Creating something than you were when you were in New York.
You just think of the way
it's a pivot point.
In New York, I created a dish and I knew when stuff was coming into season, but at the same time, the world is at our fingertips. You could get anything the next day.
And you can here too, but the emphasis.
But you almost don't want to.
Right, the emphasis is that
I want to use what's right here. I want to use what's available right at that moment and know why and know what it was used for, in Gullah Geechee cuisine, and then how I'm incorporating it into, what I'm doing and how it relates to Roman cuisine or dishes from Basilicata or from Veneto or wherever it's from, and getting to really use my brain and kind of think of Italian food, Italian cuisine, regional Italian cuisine, and incorporating these ingredients in an intelligent way, not just inserting ingredients, but actually respecting Italian cuisine and respecting the ingredients that surround us and getting to use them together. It's pretty fun.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite ingredients right now?
We're
going into early fall, but we're really sitting in late summer.
Yeah. So, corn is great. Peaches. This time of year is a layup.
It is.
So easy.
Yeah, all you have to do is be here's a peach.
Here's
and
a
people
peach.
Are like, whoa.
Here's a peach and tomato. We made sure it's perfectly ripe for you. So peaches down here are incredible. Corn is always good. All the different fresh beans and peas right now are awesome. And all of these things have a really great kind of similar ingredients that are in Italy. So it's really easy to incorporate them and use them in a very similar fashion.
So what's the number one thing for you as a chef? What is that? I know as a writer, I get asked this a lot. Mm-hmm. Like they go, what do you write about? How do you do this? And what are your fences is really what they're asking. What are the parameters? How can I put you in front of something that's going to excite you as a writer? Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time with that, answering that question, because it is like that Jesse Helms pornography thing. I don't know, but I know when I see it. Mm-hmm. And there's always this moment where I'm like, what is that?
Yeah.
And I just have this curiosity. And I know if I have the curiosity about something that it's just like gonna be work out for me in an article. How, since you are a chef, so how do you know like that's gonna be a dish? Is it more organic, or do you have a plan? Or I feel like you could have the Excel spreadsheets, Michael.
I can be organized, but the way I think about food you know, there's many different ways of breaking it down, but for me, it's always begun with understanding tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nostalgia, incorporating that in my cooking is huge, but knowing classical cuisine, whether you're cooking Italian or French or whatever it is, it's understanding cuisine, and you create great dishes from understanding the tradition and understanding why and where it came from and how it was presented, and then incorporating things. And still, that's the most important part of how I cook, is keeping the soul of the tradition, but being able to put maybe a modern twist and modern technique,
mm-hmm.
And local ingredients, applying it to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the basis of how everything comes together. No matter whether I'm flipping through, you know, my huge collection of books, or I just went to eat somewhere that was inspiring, or whatever it is, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to copy or replicate. I'm going to take ideas or just the way that something
like this,
was laid on the plate, or
yeah.
the way that, and you, that can take your imagination in a whole direction, where you may look at the dish that I got inspiration from this dish and I created this, and they have no similarities.
But it works in your mind.
Absolutely.
You get those segues between the different thoughts, and there's that. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Like, when you are you that person that's always wanting to go to the hot new places when you travel, or are you? I mean, do you? Sometimes like it pains me. I want a day off,
mm-hmm.
but then when I go eat somewhere or I read something and I'm like, this is drivel.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah.
So you can't almost turn it off, right?
That's a fact.
Yeah.
You can't turn. I mean, this is the career that I chose because I love it, and
mm-hmm.
It is hard work, but me loving it and being so passionate about it makes it enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm no stranger to working every day and working very hard, but it's fun for me, you know, and it wouldn't be worth it if it wasn't difficult. So, you know, going out to eat, yeah, it is part of work,
mm-hmm.
no matter what, you know, or just teaching my kids
to
understand.
Or you see that and you're like, damn, that's good, right?
Yeah, yeah,
do you go,
absolutely.
Damn, that's good. I want to do that. I'm excited because you're a collaborative chef. You have a lot of pop-ups,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. Do you like that collaboration?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it because it, you know, whether it's pushing myself or pushing the chef I'm working with, or, you know, you're kind of laying, when you're doing that menu planning, you're laying it out there. Because when I create, the most important part of collaborating with someone, me cooking Italian cuisine, it still remains having, it's a necessity to stay true to the way we cook pasta, the way we treat dishes, the way, you know, few ingredients are star of the show. So how do we incorporate different ingredients and still make it feel like it's
mm-hmm.
cooked in a region of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So it requires that person I'm collaborating with to really understand their cuisine, understand the stories and the reasons why those dishes came about, and how can we form any kind of resemblance in the cuisines and bring them together that makes sense.
That's fun.
You know, so
that's fun.
So much fun.
Yeah.
And that's why I love it. And
yeah.
So many chefs are like, I don't want anybody in my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. But when you do it for the first time, and then you see how much fun it, and you find fun people to do it with, and who
yeah.
are all in it, and, you know, want to achieve the same thing, just cooking great food and making people happy, and, you know, and they may be untraditional mashups of cuisine, but if you do it in a respectful way to the cuisine, it's so satisfying.
It's fun. And it gives, which I was going to hold on this, but I want to ask you about pasta in a minute,
mm-hmm.
because I really want to dig in on pasta. So just stay tuned on that. Hold
sure.
that. But you have to walk a line as a restaurateur and as a chef,
mm-hmm.
between, I would say, a neighborhood restaurant and a tourist restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So you are right on buffet, but there are millions of tourists that will never know you exist because
yeah.
they don't walk off of King Street.
Absolutely.
Or they don't walk off of East Bay. And this feels, and so they have this thing when they turn that corner and they see your courtyard,
mm-hmm.
that, oh my God, we've discovered something, and they feel local.
Totally.
Kind of. But I would say that your pop-ups and some of like your pizza nights and things like that are really for the locals.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have this tourist section, you have brunch, you have a really popular brunch. So, but how do you walk that line doing that? Because you're, in a lot of ways, a neighborhood bistro, a very big one, but very much so that way.
I mean, we always started the restaurant to be a neighborhood restaurant. We're right there on the edge of that neighborhood that is pretty large, that mm-hmm. goes all the way down to the Battery, where we're almost one of the first restaurants, not the first, but one of the first restaurants that, as you come back into town, that you would meet right there and would actually keep you from having to go into all the riffraff, and we have parking mm-hmm. and all that good stuff. So, you know, it's was definitely our goal to embrace the neighborhood and be a neighborhood restaurant, because let's face it, that's the bread and butter, no matter mm-hmm. what. As finicky as tourists can be, or the season or seasonality of, you know, when it's high season, when it's low season, for the most part, the locals are always here.
And when I go, I always see people. I'm always a hugger, for sure. And I see people I know almost every time I've ever been. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, as far as service goes, you know, it's one of the most difficult things of opening a restaurant, especially in a place that you're opening for the first time. So we worked very hard to get our service to where it is now. And
that
now,
service has to, not to interrupt, but mm-hmm. that service, when we go deeper and talk about that, it's familiarity, right?
For sure.
In a neighborhood bistro.
Mm-hmm. So it's knowing everybody who comes in and knowing what they like and knowing that they don't like to sit there and they like to sit here and knowing what their first drink is, you know, usually is, or just anticipating needs and making them feel welcome, like it's their second home,
mm-hmm.
you know, and making them feel comfortable and always being recognized is, you know, one of the most important things. So, you know, that was our huge focus.
In
huge.
A world where so much is automated, mm-hmm. and I love
the personal touch is
that
everything.
Neighborhood feel. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I love Charleston, even with the pressures. In a lot of ways right now, it's a hard place to live. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a bunch of construction. There's a bunch of tourists. There's a bunch of things that have shifted since, you know, I didn't live here. I didn't grow up here.
Yeah.
You didn't grow up here, but mm-hmm. this is now home, and so we feel very connected to it.
Of course.
But there's something that is always neighborhoody.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to say
that's why people love visiting.
Right, you know? That it felt like a small town,
yeah.
And I think walking in your restaurant, it does feel that way a little bit, hard for me to say because that restaurant used to be my favorite happy hour when I first moved.
Yeah.
At the Post and Courier. I worked for the Post and Courier, and I would go out with my girlfriends after work to Vickery's,
mm-hmm.
and we would sit there in that sunken bar.
Yeah.
So when it closed, which was no fault of yours, I held a grudge. And every time I would go with someone to the other place that was before you,
mm-hmm.
which is only a couple times. We all know why. It wasn't good. Sorry, just wasn't good.
Yeah.
I would point out, this is where this used to be, and this is where.
Yeah.
It took me, so when I came to your restaurant, I will say, it took me about twice.
Mm-hmm.
I did that about twice, and now I don't really think about that very much.
That's great. That's great.
Even though I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for that Vickery's. It is now yours. It's,
you know,
now like moved on to a new life.
What's so funny is that when we first, you know, were telling people what the space was, then we realized that we need to tell everyone it was the old Vickery space, because everybody knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have so many stories of, you know, being there, and so many memories of being a kid and then going there and drinking and in college or whatever it was. So I feel like the restaurant, in a way, has almost aged with those people.
That's a good way to put that.
That was their kind of, not dive, but that was their kind of place to go and, you know,
leverage
and comfort. And,
yeah.
Well, it's matured and over time.
And they had decent food. You know, you could get a little bite. It wasn't like, during that time of day, it wasn't a wild place.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be.
Yeah.
It could be, definitely, for sure.
So we thought it was fun that, you know, those people in their mid to late 20s now, you know, 15 years later, are enjoying it as an adult whether it's with their family or on a date night or anniversary, and it's, you know, kind of matured with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of fun to think of it.
I love that thought.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal that, actually, I think. No, I really like that idea. And I think that's important to think about the places and as a city is a living fabric, and you everybody has their sentimentality points.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just one for a lot of people
for sure.
of a certain age.
No
so.
Doubt. We know for sure.
If you rock a Vickery's t-shirt, though, that would be awesome.
Well, the fact that the owner of Vickery's comes in like 3 times a week is pretty funny, too.
There are still Vickery's available. They're just not the downtown
yeah.
one. So, but I want to talk about pasta because you make pasta in-house. Mm-hmm. And that is a long, intensive process. I'd like to talk a little bit about that like kitchen stuff.
Sure.
I'm disappointed that we're not there today. We're actually, there's so much prep that happens and so many people in and out of the restaurant. Michael popped away from service to service prep actually and probably line up
That's
today
right. yeah.
to chat with me in an office space just down the street.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate you doing that, but I haven't had a chance to tour the kitchen yet, but I know it's pretty big.
It's a good size.
And there's a lot going on there. Pasta is not that many ingredients, flour and water.
And I don't see the difference in the water. I see it simply in humidity.
Really?
And, you know, that could be, you could be in a hot kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
My kitchen was very hot at Perla. But at the same time, it was made during the day when there was no service. So there are all these nuances that you always have to be, you know, aware of
mm-hmm.
that changes your doughs, that changes the way you work the different doughs and creating the pasta. So, I mean, one of the most simple things, and I take potato gnocchi as being like the perfect example.
It's really hard
it's
to
literally
do.
Potato and flour for my recipe is just
right.
potato and flour, and I couldn't give you a recipe for it. I'd
mm-hmm.
have to show you and
because
show
it
you
changes
and
day
show
day.
You and show you mm-hmm. because it could vary like this, that, and the other depending on the temperature, depending on the humidity, and or simply the potato or how aged your potato is. And there's so many nuances of it that I can only show you and teach you what it's supposed to be like when you're working and feeling the dough. And that goes for all of our different pastas. So every day we have anywhere from 8 to 10 pasta dishes on the menu. And of those 8 to 10, there's 6 or 8 different doughs with different ratios, different flours, different, completely different things. And you're looking for different things. So
mm-hmm.
talk about understanding, you know, what you're doing. It's, I can't just give you a book and be like, hey, make my pasta.
Right.
I'm there making it with you, showing you what you're looking for. And then an intelligent person would have to absorb that and then be able to feel and know and have some sort of finesse when making the dough to be able to replicate, you know, the way I want it done.
Well, and you have to do it a lot to get some kind of muscle memory so you understand what the dough is supposed to feel like and not overworked but not underworked.
Exactly.
And right water content and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have someone dedicated to that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their full-time?
Full-time. They don't touch a single thing other than making pasta.
And about how many pieces of pasta are made every day? Because you have a, how many seats do you have?
We have 110 inside and another 45 outside.
Yeah, that's a lot of pasta.
It's a big restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody, so, most tables order at least one dish of pasta, if not two or three, right?
Yeah, pasta is
okay.
definitely the biggest
right.
seller for sure. You know, I've never quantified the amount, but it's staggering. I mean,
like how much flour do you buy a week?
So we buy anywhere from probably around 300 pounds of flour a week, you know.
And that's including your pizza crust, too.
Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore. But
oh, you don't?
No.
Okay.
But yeah, so that was a small part of it compared to mm-hmm. the amount we're using for pasta.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I love so much. It's my passion. You know,
mm-hmm.
There are a few different things that really get me excited, and pasta is definitely one of them. But it's all about the texture. Getting the right texture it's the experience, and you would only really understand if you went to Italy and were able to experience, you know, what the perfect tagliatelle is or the perfect agnolotti or having, you know, the perfect tagliatelle and understanding the textures, because it's one thing to just make a noodle, cook it, and then be like, oh, this is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's one thing to experience like the perfect texture. So.
And matching the, I think a lot of home cooks would love to hear you answer this question,
mm-hmm.
matching the pasta to the dish,
sure.
the pasta shape,
mm-hmm.
because I think I included maybe only have 2 dried pastas at home.
Okay.
And then if I ever do any fresh, it's either tortellini or fettuccine, because I can cut that thick.
Sure.
But I'm not the normal. I don't have a pasta machine. Mm-hmm. They're not hard to do.
Yeah.
It's not hard to do with a pasta roller, but...
I mean, the longer noodles are usually, not in every case, but usually with a very simple, light dish where you're letting those long, thin noodles like a linguine or a spaghetti or like a tagliatelle especially, where those are very lightly dressed and it's all about the long noodle with just a little bit of something to glaze and flavor those noodles. You know, and that's what a lot of people misunderstand. They don't quite understand is the it's all about the noodle with just a little bit of something dressing it. And it's not the other way around. It shouldn't be drowning in, you know, the sauce and you're sitting
but
in
if
a pool
you
of
make
sauce,
really shitty noodles,
then you have to do
then
that.
You have to yeah, do, exactly. Or you're like, I don't know what al dente is.
Yeah.
Then, you know, you just pile bolognese on top of
absolutely.
It and call it a day.
Yeah.
So what is the wide, the super wide flat one?
The pappardelle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have become a huge fan of that because the dishes are usually right in my alley, but there's something just so delicate about that. And it seems the opposite of what I would consider on a pasta that size,
you know,
pasta shape. That
so
size.
The first time I had pappardelle, I was, I had just accepted the job at Babbo and I went to eat there with, at the time, my girlfriend, who's now my wife. We had the tasting menu at Babbo and sat in the front and it was the second course, which is at that time was the, it changes throughout the seasons, but it's always pappardelle, simply dressed with butter, pasta water, a wild mushroom, and a little bit of thyme, finished with parmigiano. So that was like this moment, my first pasta moment, because going into it, I was French, I was trained French, cooked French food. That was what I knew of cooking. And so going into Babbo was really exciting for me to be in a completely different style of kitchen.
But that's when that captured your
everything,
not your imagination only, but your heart.
That's
there was
sure.
there was a visceral reaction to
absolutely.
That dish.
So then I tasted that simply dressed. I at that moment I'd never heard of a noodle just pasta water and butter. If I grew up, you know, my mom would coat spaghetti with butter plain, but to have this sauce that perfectly coated, it wasn't greasy, that was emulsified, a little bit of thyme, and then these beautifully sauteed chanterelles. And just a little parmigiano, and it was, I mean, that's so Italian that it would be so simply dressed and only a few ingredients and just letting the texture of that noodle just shine through the whole dish. And then I understood it at that moment, like, or at least began to understand it.
I want to understand
yeah,
that.
That's a fact.
I feel this.
Yeah.
I want to understand
for
it
the
now.
First time now, oh, you don't have to cover it in flavors. You don't have to layer all these different ingredients and flavors. And it was that first moment of restraint of, you know, and that's what a skilled chef knows is restraint. They after years of training and realizing that I don't need this ingredient, I don't need this ingredient. Now I have three to five ingredients on a plate that are beautiful, that are perfectly in season, perfectly ripe or cooked, or and then just one thing being the star of the show and those little accents of it. And that was like the perfect dish that kind of explained that.
So are you always chasing that dish, like in your mind?
You know,
maybe or subconscious, you're like, I want to hit it. Have you ever made a dish that you had a reaction similar to that when you tasted it?
I'm always very critical and cynical of my own dishes when I'm eating them. So I don't know that I ever am relaxed enough to be able to enjoy it the same way. So I hope one day that I can. But, so no, I've never had that experience. I know that we, you know, make great pasta and execute it well. And I definitely know how to make a dish like that. But, you know, that moment, the moment I had, the agnolotti that I, you know, based my agnolotti off of in Piemonte at Ugo Alciotti's restaurant Guido, in Palenzo. And it was just the most magical moment where I tasted this agnolotti that his mother had been making for years and years, and she was famous for it. And he's this very well-known Italian chef and just executes the most perfect texture, perfect filling, perfectly dressed. That was another, like the second moment of really understanding what that filled pasta is supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was even more so than the pappardelle, like a moment that just made me even more excited. And I brought that back to Manzo at that moment. And since then, I've always had an agnolotti on my menu that was different from that one, but the same idea. Mm-hmm. That his version is as traditional as could possibly be, the agnolotti al sugo di arrosto. And like my duck is a version of that.
Mm-hmm. Which is, right. I was going to mention is really good. Well, I think that's probably the perfect passionate ending to a Michael Toscano interview. So if people want to learn more about Michael and his beautiful restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. We're going to have links to the restaurant so you can check it out. Also an image of him. He is a very snappy dresser. So I'm sure his headshot, I think I've seen it. It's very stylish. Snappy dressers like I am in the 1940s. Yes, that is true. I just said that. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review or tell somebody about it or subscribe or any of those other things that you do, just like when you like a restaurant. Because I love having the chance to talk to chefs like Michael for my job. This is a really good job. So despite the fact that I'm not eating pasta or drinking Amaro at this minute. So thank you
so much,
Michael.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations. But in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?